All right, everyone, a quick podcast update. The TLDR is that I'm now offering subscriptions on Fountain. If you're interested, please listen. If not, skip ahead a minute and 30 seconds and continue enjoying the episodes as you always have. About a year and a half or 2 years ago, I was talking to the Fountain team and told them if they ever started to offer a podcast hosting platform that I would be interested in being one of the first people to try it. They're just launching that feature, so I've moved my podcast host from where it was previously to Fountain. And one of the things that Fountain makes really easy is offering subscriptions. So as of this episode, if you want to subscribe, you can have access to ad-free episodes. I'm also beginning to record bonus content for each interview episode, which of course doesn't include the roundup episodes. So a couple times per month, you'll be getting some additional content from the guests discussing whatever they think might be valuable for you, the listener. Another thing I've done in the past that was very well received that I'm planning to continue doing on a more consistent basis is roundtable discussions, and anyone who subscribes to the podcast will get access to those either to attend and participate live or to listen to after the fact. I personally don't think that ad-free episodes are worth $5 a month, but I do think this additional content could be beneficial. So if you want to give it a try, great. If not, like I said, keep on listening to the podcast as you always have. Nothing will change. Generally, I'll release the bonus interview content the same day an interview goes live, but for today's interview, I'll actually be releasing that next week. After that, you can expect bonus content every couple of weeks in addition to those roundtable discussions. For those who are interested, I'll see you on the other side. Is there a way to get to a $10 million Bitcoin without the financialization of the asset?
Bitcoin is in competition with other store value assets. I think Bitcoin in that case is going to eat a large chunk of those equity and fixed income or debt markets because they're not actually scarce.
Wall Street has no issue financializing Bitcoin. Do you see the Bitcoinization of finance as a way to bring Bitcoin principles into Wall Street and into finance?
Paper Bitcoin is a threat to Bitcoin. Bitcoin's super feature is that anyone can take custody of it in 10 minutes around the world. There's really no excuse for Bitcoin not to settle at the end of the trade.
If you had to make a prediction right now, would you say that the financialization of Bitcoin will likely lead to higher highs, or will it be something that in the end maybe hurts more than it helps? Welcome to the Bitcoin Playbook, where we discuss proven strategies for using Bitcoin in your business. I'm your host, Josh Friedemann, and our guest today is Wyatt O'Rourke, who is the CEO of a wealth management firm called Basilic and the author of The Bitcoinization of Finance. Here is Wyatt O'Rourke. Wyatt, welcome to the podcast.
Dude, thanks so much for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
So I'd like to start off every single interview with a few questions that help us to get to know you a little bit better and give us some insight for our own lives. Are you ready for these?
Absolutely.
Question number one is this: when and how did you first learn about Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it's honestly kind of a meme, but I'm pretty sure it was like 2017, and a kid I knew in college was participating in some illicit activities using Bitcoin. And at the time, you know, I was studying finance, and so it just like fit the narrative, you know, perfectly, which is kind of a shame, you know, among other things, like, oh, you know, it doesn't cash flow. You know, it's like I was unfortunately, like, I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, getting, you know, brainwashed by Keynesian economics. But in 2020, when I was locked in my apartment with my roommate, Noah, he was just berating me about Bitcoin, and I kind of escaped. So finally gave in and listened to the Investors Podcast, Press and Pitch. That was my first Bitcoin podcast, and really just, you know, the rest is history. Dove down the rabbit hole there. I think that was in at least one of his first 10 episodes, and I just loved it.
Question number two, what's an insight or fact about Bitcoin that you wish everyone understood?
Yeah, I wish people knew or fully grasped like how truly decentralized and anti-fragile this is. You know, I'm kind of, yeah, I came to Bitcoin kind of from the finance lens. That's, you know, what my background is. You know, have a wealth management firm. So I generally am talking to people about like the finance or money or economics angle. So it's a little bit harder for me to introduce this. I think you got to be a little bit more technical, but I think this is like one of the most beautiful things about Bitcoin. And it's very hard to find, create, or maintain decentralized systems. And when we find them, I think we should really cherish and protect them. And so I just think there's so much value that comes out of a decentralized system and not having, you know, a country, company, or entity that can be in control of the Bitcoin network is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Question three, what's the Bitcoin resource you most recommend to other people?
The Bitcoinization of finance. If you're into that, I do think it's a great resource. I am a podcast junkie. There's a bunch of great ones out there, but honestly, I mainly advocate for Bitcoiners to lean into their local communities, like get involved with your local Bit Devs, your Bitcoin and beer. I think there's so much more you can learn about Bitcoin in person just from, you know, interacting with clubs in real life. Hmm.
Beyond Bitcoin, what is a resource, tool, or idea that's been helpful to you or your work recently?
Yeah, totally. So over the last 3 years, I've had a pretty profound faith reconversion. Grew up Catholic and kind of fell away from it. And then, you know, I've really kind of got back into the faith. And that's just really helped me solidify my moral worldview and grounded my life and beliefs in God, which has really helped me, you know, simplify things. So having like a moral framework that I'm like rooted in has like helped me better assess, you know, problems or technologies as they arise. And it's like, okay, now I have a lens I can like view and assess these things through.
Now we have our final, what we call our arbitrary but insightful question, which is this: as a general life principle, is it better to ask why or why not?
I love this question. I actually plugged it into ChatGPT. It was like playing around back and forth with it, like quizzing myself. And I ended up on why not? I'm a self-proclaimed, you know, techno-optimist. You know, I think humans are technological beings, and that's an inherent gift from God. And that we're, you know, called to boldly go out in the world and build. So as problems arise, you know, I think we can innovate through them. We have a long history of doing so. And so the why not to me seems like a little bit more optimistic outtake on the question.
So Wyatt, we're here today to talk about your book, The Bitcoinization of Finance. This podcast, for people who have been listening for a while, will know it used to be called Business Bitcoinization. I actually dropped that because no one could seem to remember the name. Even, you know, close friends, they'd be talking about it, who are Bitcoiners, right? So they're familiar with the idea of Bitcoinization. They kind of would forget the title of the podcast. So I changed it to The Bitcoin Playbook. And here we are talking about the Bitcoinization of finance today. I want to hear a little bit about it, but I think there are a lot of Bitcoiners that are not very comfortable right now with the financialization of Bitcoin. Is the Bitcoinization of finance just a clever turn of phrase, or is there a difference between that and the financialization of Bitcoin?
It's both, actually. So, you know, I'm certainly no fan of our lives being financialized, and I think that, you know, they certainly have, and I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. However, you know, I kind of view the financialization of Bitcoin as applying traditional financial tools, products, and strategies to Bitcoin. You know, that's things like the Bitbond. However, the Bitcoinization of finance is a financial system where custody, settlement, and value are unified in one protocol. And so in doing so, we really kind of remove the paper layer in finance, where a lot of the shenanigans happens. And so, you know, when I think of Bitcoinization of anything, you know, it's like this black hole thesis that, you know, Bitcoin will suck it all up. And so I think that, you know, that's particularly going to happen in finance too. You know, I kind of think that every industry is prone to fiatness or like fakeness, and finance was particularly susceptible because, you know, kind of generally view it as like the business of money. And so when we apply Bitcoin, you know, to a financial system or try to rework a financial system, you know, around Bitcoin, I think it's mainly just like expanding, you know, capital markets, which is just a function of capitalism. You know, two parties can, you know, each take a side of a trade. That trade can be multiplied for each, you know, market participant determining for themselves which side of the trade they want to be on. And, you know, I'm certainly, you know, aware and sympathetic to a lot of cases of Bitcoiners being skeptical of finance. I think, you know, that's fair. That being said, like it's not something we should shun. You know, we have, you know, a playbook that we can apply to Bitcoin that I think will ultimately lead to hyper Bitcoinization, because ultimately, like, if that's a case, which, you know, sure, we agree on, capital has to get into Bitcoin somehow, right? And so it's like, it's really going to be finance that's going to like build the tools, products, and strategies to do that.
If you were hit by a bus right now, could your family access your Bitcoin? When's the right time to stop hodling and use Bitcoin to impact your family's lives, not just yours? What if Bitcoin doesn't reach the value you expect, or it takes longer to reach that value? Do you have a plan? Do you have the proper trust structure to avoid probate, maintain your privacy, and minimize taxes? Do you want to avoid taxes to stack more sats or leverage your stack without selling? Should you add Bitcoin to your business's balance sheet? Are you truly confident in your self-custody setup? If any of those questions made you stop and think, you probably realize that simply buying and holding Bitcoin is not a complete financial plan. That's where Strong Wealth comes in. Orange-pilled advisors blending traditional financial planning with deep Bitcoin expertise, giving you the best of both worlds, so you can sleep peacefully knowing you're making the right moves for your family no matter what happens. Schedule a free call at strongwealth.net. That's strongwealth.net. Strong Wealth, wealth management for Bitcoiners by Bitcoiners. So one of the things you have at the end of your book is kind of the potential of Bitcoin. And there are all sorts of very bullish takes, also very bearish takes about where Bitcoin could go in the future. At the end of the day, no one knows. But one of the things you cite is Jesse Myers, also known as Croesus, his Once in a Species blog. And he talks about how essentially Bitcoin will likely steal away from various other stores of value, at least a certain percentage of what other people store, for instance, in real estate or wherever else. So he thinks that over time, the approximately $900 trillion in assets across the globe, the 225 of that will be in Bitcoin. So I guess part of the question is for Bitcoiners that don't like the idea of the financialization of Bitcoin, is there a way to get to that point? Or maybe a $10 million Bitcoin without coming into the financialization of the asset?
Yeah, definitely. No, it's a great question. I absolutely love this graph. I think Jesse's done, you know, phenomenal work. And he really kind of frames this piece. It's like Bitcoin is in competition with other store value assets. And, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners are, you know, libertarian. They believe in free markets. I think that's all that this really is. And, you know, we don't necessarily need to, you know, overthink it at its base case. And, you know, to me, you know, I've learned a lot from Lynn Alden. You know, she talks about, you know, money being, you know, a technology. And we've seen like the evolution of different monies and some of their technological, you know, advantages or drawbacks. And so if we believe Bitcoin is money, which I do, and it's like the next technical evolution of, you know, fiat money or paper money, which, you know, we resent and rightfully so. But, you know, at the time, you know, it allowed for simpler cross-border payments, you know, it was faster to move than, you know, commodity money like gold. So, you know, at its early beginning when it was like most true, like there was a more clear case for like the technological evolution of fiat money. So, you know, when we apply Bitcoin bring Bitcoin into the picture now, we look at like the total store value assets that are available, you know, in the world. In the chart, you know, it's very simple. He just lays it out in like a couple different squares and like assigns, you know, market cap to each category. So, you know, I think of things like, you know, collectibles and art, you know, it's like, can Bitcoin compete with those things? You know, yes, certainly they can. Generally, you know, if somebody's holding those, they're, you know, probably in a income bracket where they're, you know, more cushioned than the rest of us for, you know, different types of asset movements. But, you know, when you look at the bulk of it, it's, you know, real estate, equities, and, you know, some sort of fixed income or debt instrument. And so, you know, particularly in the US, you know, I think this is pretty, you know, representative around the world, but real estate is generally like the most scarce liquid asset that people can get their hands onto. You know, that's why we see all this monetary premium on top of, you know, housing, you know, in particular in the US or, you know, even Canada. You know, Vancouver is pretty famous now for, you know, Chinese, you know, investors trying to store their wealth, you know, in an asset outside of China. And that's easiest for them to do in real estate in another country. And so, you know, store value asset, I think, you know, first and foremost, is just scarce. You know, that's hence like the store of value, you know, over time and space that asset will generally, you know, appreciate. And so, you know, real estate kind of has like a place in the world. Obviously, there's a lot of utility value, you know, we get from real estate. And, you know, I certainly don't mind, you know, buildings, you know, going up in value, especially as their utility value or, you know, local, you know, hyper-local property, you know, becomes more desired. So there's that. than equities and fixed income, I certainly have, you know, more of a gripe with, because, you know, fixed income is the largest, you know, market in the world. And it, debt certainly has its place in the world, too. I'm not as negative on debt as a lot of people. You know, I think it's just a tool. But, you know, when we kind of, you know, peel back the layers of the onion, it's important to identify what kind of debt are we working with. The majority of that debt is sovereign debt. And so, you know, if you were to try to store your wealth in sovereign debt, you know, at this day and age, like, you're just going to get paid back with printed money. So that's actually not a store of value. And, you know, I think Bitcoin in that case is going to eat a large chunk of those equity and fixed income or debt markets, because they're not actually scarce.
So I think you've already addressed this a little bit earlier, but Wall Street has no issue financializing Bitcoin, taking advantage of it, you know, creating products, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see the Bitcoinization of finance as a way to bring Bitcoin principles into Wall Street and into finance? And then maybe connected to that, what are the areas that you're most bullish on when it comes to the Bitcoinization of finance?
Definitely. This is a fun one, because you definitely can offend both the finance bros and the Bitcoiners. So I'm just trying to blaze my own path here right down the middle. But so I think, you know, first and foremost, like, paper Bitcoin is a threat to Bitcoin. You know, it's not bad that it necessarily exists, but Bitcoin's super feature, in my opinion, is that anyone can take custody of it in 10 minutes, you know, around the world. And part of the problem we've seen with gold, and, you know, people have been crying foul on, like, gold markets for, you know, decades now, that they're manipulated. And this largely is like a finance game. So if you have a finite asset that's scarce, like gold, and it, you know, it's physical, and then you put a unscarce paper product on top of it, it becomes, like, much easier to skew that market. How I think a Bitcoin, or, you know, a financial system becomes Bitcoinized is really in the settlement layer. And so the fact that, you know, Bitcoin is a money and an asset in one protocol, and then it settles, you know, natively on the same protocol, like, there's really no excuse for Bitcoin not to settle at the end of a trade. So, you know, I have no problem with, like, a futures contract, right? At the end of the day, that's just, you know, a business contract between two parties looking to, you know, hedge exposure. If we apply that to Bitcoin, great, still a business contract of two parties trying to hedge exposure. This is just free market principles. Where I think we need to push the industry and encourage, you know, Bitcoin companies and companies partaking in these kind of financial activities is to settle that contract in Bitcoin, right? There's no reason for that contract to settle in cash. And that's where, you know, we tend to distort markets. So I really do call and talk about this on the book to for people working in the Bitcoin industry or Bitcoin companies, you know, building solutions in the space, is to embrace the, I would call it, like, the ethos of Bitcoin. So it's like, are you doing things like the Bitcoin way? It's like, in this instance, like, are you actually, you know, taking it upon yourself to build into the business model settling in Bitcoin? Like, there's some hash rate futures products out there right now that they may just made a business model decision that they'll settle in cash. Like, there's nothing actually preventing them from settling in hash rate. They just made a decision. It's like, well, as Bitcoiners, we should hold those companies, you know, accountable. And if they have competitors that actually settle in hash rate or settle in Bitcoin, like, we should use those companies, right? And so, you know, Bitcoin is still, I would say, you know, evolving industry. And I think it's very important at this point in time for Bitcoiners to do, like, some self-regulation, you're right? We don't want to make, you know, big mistakes where, you know, consumers or, you know, people get hurt. Obviously, that is a function of markets and it's going to happen. But what we're really trying to avoid, or should aim to avoid, is, like, big blowups. And, you know, I think we do that by, you know, encouraging business to be done a certain way. You know, I always direct my clients to River because they have proof of reserves. They use 203 cold storage, you know, multi-custody or multi-signature custody. And so it's like, are they doing it the right way? If we all hold ourselves, you know, accountable to doing it the right way, you know, we should mitigate, you know, a lot of those potential, you know, blowups or reason for, you know, regulation, you know, hammer to come down on the industry.
Today's episode of Business Bitcoinization is proudly brought to you by Velus Commerce, where the future of business technology meets Bitcoin. As we journey through the era of Bitcoin and its transformational impact on businesses, there's one name that stands out. Velus Commerce. Whether you're looking to build a cutting-edge website, a seamless mobile app, or custom software, Velus is your go-to team. They've been diving deep into the world of Bitcoin since 2014, making them one of the most experienced groups for integrating Bitcoin and Lightning payments into a variety of digital platforms. But here's what truly sets them apart. Velus Commerce doesn't just build. They bring a wealth of knowledge to ensure your project's success from day one. Their team understands the nuances of Bitcoin, ensuring that your business stays ahead of the curve. And for all business Bitcoinization listeners out there, Velus Commerce is offering a free consultation to kickstart your project the right way. So if you're ready to future-proof your business in the coming age of hyper-Bitcoinization, head over to veluscommerce.com or reach out on Twitter at veluscommerce. Let's make sure your business thrives in the Bitcoin era. So Saylor has been pretty vocal about his stance on proof of reserves. He thinks that, I don't want to put words into his mouth. You can find exactly what he would say if you want to search YouTube or wherever else you're listening to this. But he would essentially say that it opens up strategy to unnecessary risk. Do you think that all Bitcoin treasury companies, all companies in general, should have proof of reserves? How important is that? You mentioned that just a second ago with River.
Yeah, I do think it's very important. I'm somewhat sympathetic to what he's saying, but at the end of the day, you know, specifically when we're talking about Bitcoin, you know, treasury companies, they are just treating, you know, this asset as a, or they're just treating Bitcoin as an asset on their balance sheet. So if that's the case, then yeah, like show me the address, like show me you have the Bitcoin you say you do. And, you know, to be fair, like public companies, you know, they do have different, you know, reporting requirements that, you know, they already have to go through. So a lot of that is kind of pseudo, you know, taken care of. I would rather be, you know, the Bitcoiner way as opposed to like the SEC way and just showing the address. And, you know, I think that's also, you know, specifically with the treasury companies, if there are ETFs or, you know, any financial, you know, company that is looking to, you know, compete within the Bitcoin ecosystem, I think that's a way you can really kind of get above the competition, especially if not a lot of players are doing it. But, you know, if you're a smaller business, you know, I'm not necessarily saying it's, you know, pertinent to, you know, show your Bitcoin treasury. But, you know, if you are holding client funds or, you know, holding funds on behalf of investors, I think it is, you know, very important. And I think there's more than one way you can skin a cat here. But, you know, I think it's, you know, important we're always opting for the most true and honest manner.
Mm-hmm. So let's say that proof of reserves aligns with the Bitcoin ethos you were talking about a second ago. What would be some of the other things that you would like to see companies interacting with Bitcoin developing as far as their processes, practices, standards?
Totally. I think this is like really apparent for me in like the lending ecosystem right now. You know, a lot of clients ask me about this. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, I think that's a tool. And, you know, I think we're at an interesting point in time, you know, in the lifespan of Bitcoin where, you know, we can use Bitcoin as collateral to kind of satisfy some dollar denominated liabilities. I don't think it will always, you know, work that way. You know, once, you know, Bitcoin becomes a unit account, like that's, you know, essentially kind of a mute point. You know, loans and debt will still exist. It's just like the structure will be a little different. And so when I'm evaluating, you know, potential, you know, lending partner that, you know, I would, you know, recommend or guide a client to, I do like some pretty, you know, thorough, you know, due diligence. And a lot of these are just kind of like more fun, like Bitcoin maxi points, you know, I have. You know, if I go to your website and I see like a bar chart, you're like instantly axed. Like, I don't want to see any sort of like red or green candles flashing in my face, trying to, you know, encourage, you know, some sort of trading activity. I think that's wrong. And a lot of those companies, I don't think are moral actors. You see a lot of this in the crypto space. And, you know, I really, you advise we stay away from those practices. I think it's, you know, very fiat and, you know, high time preference behavior. You know, if there's any sort of sidechain staking token automatically axed, you know, we're Bitcoiners, we're looking to interact with the bear asset. You know, I don't want some wrapped Bitcoin product or staked on something, you know, not on the Bitcoin protocol, because, you know, we just introduced so many different layers of risk that, for one, aren't necessary. And, you know, at that point, I'm just skeptical of who's trying to make a buck. And then when you ultimately kind of get into, you know, the terms of the deal, so you kind of found, you know, a reputable company, and when you're getting the nuts and bolts, or it's like I focus, you know, predominantly on the custody solution, I'm a collaborative 203 multi-sig advocate. That's always what I'm looking for first and foremost. I think that's kind of the gold standard. You know, I think Unchained has absolutely nailed this. If somebody custodies, you know, it's a fully custody solution with somebody like BitGo, I would prefer it's collaborative, you know, multi-sig, but I'm not going to necessarily not do business with them. I think, you know, BitGo is a reputable company, and, you know, confident in their custody solutions. But that would probably, you know, kind of be like a yellow flag. But then, you know, we, you know, look very carefully at like LTV margins, you know, so if like somebody is, you know, advertising like up to 80% LTV, I probably won't do business with them, or that's falling into like yellow or red flag territory there, because they're trying to simulate or encourage riskier behavior like off the bat. You know, it's like we haven't even done a loan agreement. Your calculator just starts at 80% LTV. So it's like, okay, well, now we're automatically starting in a riskier situation. How the loans are paid back, you know, how the LTV is charged, this really kind of gets in the fine print. It's like some of the slimier companies will do like daily, you know, APY. And so it's like, well, at the end of the term, you know, it might actually be, you know, much larger interest cost that you're on the hook for. So really kind of dig into that. And then I would say kind of lastly is like the repayment terms. So it's like, you know, are they going to be, you know, communicative partners? Are they going to give you notice? And like, you know, if you're getting close to like your margin call LTV, are they going to notify you? Are they going to immediately, you know, liquidate your Bitcoin if you don't top it off? And so it's really kind of taking all those into account. If I could, you know, kind of recap that, it's like, are they following, you know, the Bitcoin ethos, you know, using, you know, tools and technologies already enabled innately on the Bitcoin protocol? And then kind of on the business side, like, do I get a sense of, are they, you know, ethical actors and doing things the right way, like not trying to hide, you know, daily interest rates and like the fine print?
So I think you're familiar with recent conversations on the show about Bitcoin treasury companies. Are you of the opinion that most of the moves, most of the announcements in recent days with treasury companies, those are companies that are acting in good faith? And maybe, you know, it's hard to answer. Maybe I'm not going to have you answer for specific ones, but just, do you get the sense that things are heading in a good direction in that regard? Or are you of the opinion that this is kind of maybe setting up a precedent that could lead to the next bear market?
Yeah, man, I go really back and forth on this. And I think if I, you know, land it, I'm probably maybe like 60% bearish, 40% bullish on like just this idea in general. So I'm very bullish on, you know, like I mentioned, you know, deeper capital markets, you know, within Bitcoin. I think, you know, public companies are certainly a tool for that. You know, we talked about, you know, futures, you know, options. Those are all tools for that. You know, ETFs are a tool for that. You know, when I look at the other tools like futures and ETFs, like BlackRock earlier this year, certainly no fan of them, but to their credit, did file for in-kind redemption of their ETF. And so it's like, that's really, you know, what I'm looking for is like in-kind settlement, or, you know, financial contracts and products like settling or being denominated in Bitcoin. I think that's what we got to strive for. And that's like the gold standard. Treasury companies don't have that option, right? And so, we're, you know, we're generally just dealing with, you know, common shares more often than not. If they're a very sophisticated treasury company like MicroStrategy, I think they're in a league of their own, partly because of their genius, partly because, you know, first movers, you know, where they have a very well thought out and financially engineered, you know, balance sheet. They have multiple levers they can pull in a litany of scenarios, whether it's their common stock, you know, they have three levels of preferred shares now, they have the convertible debt. And so we just kind of put them off to the side as kind of an outlier. You're really just dealing with common shares, like more often than not. Even, you know, convertible debt's like very popular, and then you really kind of got to get in the terms of that convertible debt. But when I think of these things, you know, these Bitcoin, you know, treasury companies at large, like I'm mostly concerned about, you know, Bitcoiners not fully understanding like they're wading into traditional capital markets. You know, it obviously is kind of it is kind of obvious, like you're buying common shares, but I'm not sure they understand like everything that comes with playing in a different realm. Like this isn't Bitcoin anymore. Like you're buying a publicly traded company that just happens to have Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So there's all sorts of different shenanigans that can be, you know, had in traditional financial markets. You know, I don't think that the 25th, you know, treasury company is going to necessarily have good debt terms. And I think some of these will blow up and then there will be like domino effects, you know, from there. So, you know, we've seen time and time again in, you know, traditional capital markets where, you know, a submarket gets hyper-focused on a particular metric, like that generally doesn't, you know, end well. It kind of leads to like bubble behavior or like some sort of craze, you know, community adjusted EBITDA, you know, comes to mind when like WeWork was hot, you know, a while back. And so I don't like to see stuff like that. And I am seeing it with the Bitcoin treasury markets. And maybe this is too principled of a stance and not necessarily fair, but this is really, you know, I don't like fault them. Like it's fair game for them to apply the strategy, but it really is just like finance and accounting tricks. And, you know, to me, this just a lot of times feels like a LBO playbook, you know, like leverage buyouts. It's like, you know, Toys R Us, you can Google this like famous example, like private equity firm buys company, takes a private, leverages up with debt, and then, you know, they just optimize for like one metric, or, you know, they're just playing finance and accounting tricks. And I'm really kind of getting that same sort of vibe. But, you know, I like business. I like capitalism. I think companies are supposed to provide value. So if you have a company that just takes over, you know, another company, not throwing shade at any one of them, but it's like, what does this company actually do? It's like, oh, don't worry about it. It's like this health, you know, medical device company. So it's okay. So are they going to actually make any cash flow off that business? Are they going to leave like their customers, existing customers, in the dust and not service them like they initially set out to do, you know, when that company was founded and went public? Are they not just trying to acquire Bitcoin? And that just seems like, you know, mission drift to me. And I think that's, you know, likely to cause some harm. So I don't know. That's where my head's at, you know, when I see these things where it's like, I don't hate it, because I think, you know, this is important for Bitcoin getting more ingrained in traditional capital markets. But at the same time, it's like, it does feel like we're kind of missing the forest from the trees.
If you had to make a prediction right now, would you say that the financialization of Bitcoin in this cycle will likely lead to higher highs where we no longer have the 4-year cycle, or will it be something that in the end maybe hurts more than it helps?
That's a great question. I'll make a bold prediction here. It's like, I actually am kind of leaning towards like the end of cycles. And for a couple of reasons. So it's important, you know, understand it's like Bitcoin's like a unique asset for like many reasons, a lot of what we just talked about. So it's like, I do think there are certain, you know, valuation metrics or even like adoption metrics from previous technologies or financial products, like we can apply to Bitcoin to get a sense of what it is and where it's going. But we do need to treat it as something special. Where I really, you know, see kind of like the end of cycles, and, you know, there'll still be ups and downs. I'm not saying it's like up forever, but when Bitcoin was just Bitcoin, you know, it was doing its own thing, having cycles, like it was very, you know, very methodical in how it operated because it was a new technology. Now, as, you know, Bitcoin becomes more ingrained in traditional capital markets, one of the things I do think treasury companies are good at, and this is actually kind of like with gold too, where it's like, gold actually does very well with like small transactions. It actually kind of fails or is weaker with like large transactions and settlements. I kind of see that with treasury companies too, where it's like, I don't necessarily think a lot of these are fit or worth the attention of like retail investors, but they are opportunities for, you know, large pools of capital that may not be able to invest directly into spot Bitcoin or an ETF to get Bitcoin exposure, which I'm certainly a fan of. So just going back to, you know, Jesse's chart, you know, if Bitcoin is competing with other store value assets, and we're already starting to see, you know, some of those store value assets bleeding market share to Bitcoin, and as we get more financial products that allow big or pools of capital to flow into Bitcoin, you know, I think that's almost like a water spout, like you can't turn off, or it's like you might be able to slow the flow, you know, if one thing or the other happens. But it will ultimately be changed, I think, more or less forever going forward.
So if we are out of the four-year cycle, then this question right here, there's a lot of, it's very open to interpretation. But let me ask you this. How high do you think Bitcoin will go before its next 50% or more drawback?
Oh, man. Yeah, I really try not to do like the price prediction game. But, you know, I think it's kind of funny. You know, this is just like human like lizard brain things. Like we're just set on like round numbers. There's this great gentleman, I'm forgetting his name, but he presented at Texas Energy Mining Summit, I believe is like his project's like UTXO Oracle. And, you know, he just showed some data about like, you know, consolidations and stuff at like $100, $1,000. So I imagine, you know, we could get to a round number like 250,000 or so. Not financial advice, but, you know, also too, you know, as Bitcoin, you know, becomes more ingrained in capital markets, something, you know, we need to identify and understand like finance. And that's, you know, what I'm really trying to do with the book, because like, yeah, traders are people too, or, you know, people hedging their opportunities. Like they're more or less going to do that at something like $150,000. Like, okay, I've made X amount of profit, I'm going to take some off the table. You know, this is, you know, my sell limit's at. And so I think, you know, we should probably look out for some sort of higher round number. I'd be, you know, certainly welcome it. But I've heard, you know, some pretty credible people that I believe like 250 sounds like appropriate, you know, this cycle. Who knows though?
So Wyatt, we've scratched the surface is a massive overstatement when it comes to your book. So I highly recommend people check it out, and you can download it for free. But maybe if you would share with people where they can go to find the Bitcoinization of Finance and keep up with you and your work.
Absolutely. So you can find the Bitcoinization of Finance on brains.com under their book section. You can find me online on Twitter at @WyattOrourke_. You can find out more about my firm, Basilic. You know, kind of brand myself as a Bitcoin financial advisor. We help people with, you know, sound money, you know, strategies, you know, integrating Bitcoin into a financial plan. One of the things, you know, we're really focused on is like, we're the first generation of Bitcoiners, you know, whether we like it or not. So there's a lot of responsibility, you know, that falls on our shoulders. Make sure we're good stewards of the asset. And you can find more information there at basilic.io or some of my personal writings at wyattorourke.com.
Excellent. Well, Wyatt, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Josh, thanks for having me.
Well, friends, it's a wrap. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bitcoin Playbook. If you want to reach out to either me or Wyatt, you can find those links down in the show notes. And be sure to pick up your free copy of the Bitcoinization of Finance. As always, keep building, keep growing. Until next time, keep living and leading well.